Thank you for coming out on this warm night to hear all these hot poets and others. So I'm really very pleased to be here, and pleased that you're here as well. I want to put this file folder down and just emerge, so to speak, with my usual motherload of papers here. So this evening, as I was traveling to come here, I thought of a quote, and I hope I can get it right. It's sort of a little tongue twister, and apropos of nothing but wanting to share something from somebody else initially. The quote is from Ted Hughes, and it has to do with thinking. And what he said once, and I do not know exactly why he said it, was that if you don't use your mind lies in you like a fish in a pond of a man who cannot fish. And I don't even know why it came to me, but somehow I thought it was so extraordinary. And I wanted just to use it and wanted to share it with you. I want to go from there to, if I would find that piece, to another a poet whose line stayed in my head, and so I'm just really sort of talking to you at the moment, obviously. And it was Adrienne Rich. The line was very curious to me, and what she said in the context of a very wonderful reading with other poets really startled me, and it was published after her death, which was very recent, and it was that language is a map of our failures. So I went and tracked that down. It sounded pretty negative for a poet. And what she meant by that is really something that was the opposite, because it was at the end of reading of a wonderful poetry reading. And what she the occasion for the poetry reading was an extraordinary event to raise money for the hungry. And what she did was to go on and say that they did so well, the people who had read, that they had to simply behold the quality of the poets, and in a way, she said, nothing matches up to that cause of poverty. So those are the two things somehow that stayed with me. And how I orchestrated this reading, I think everything is connected. Sometimes that's a difficulty, and most of the time it's not. So I want to start by reading a poem called Legacy, that is not in the book, because I have never addressed, and there are several poems that are on this subject, this subject. One of the subjects, one of the wonderful opportunities that I've had, is to be given a grant to work on poetry in the Ladino language. And Ladino is an extinct language that was carried with the Sephardic Jews from Spain and is preserved. It's the only preservation for troubadour poetry. And you can find this language not only sung, but you can find it in Madrid, and scholars study these songs. Well, anyway, I'm going to start with this poem called Legacy, and it's for my companion, and we actually reworked our steps in Spain and in Greece to track down the ancestors and to interview some people who actually were still speaking this language. So this is for Marguerite and for history. And what we did was to visit Macedonia, and there found a synagogue to which only two people belonged. But it isn't called Macedonia by the Greeks. I'll just start right in here. Without you telling me the name Demaios is here on this white pillar, I would not know, my fingers never able to trace mystical Hebrew letters on walls as you could do. You were able to tell me, look, they were here in Salonika, and they were there in Yanina. The moon was simple that day in the square of that quarter. And now there is one man with the whitest shirt by the light of tomorrow's sun in our memory, Victor, a man with a bruised key, opens the gates to ancient streets. He said he was all that was left. He would sweep the cracked alleys, light the candles, and put new ribbons on the posts for us. He would come for anyone to this holy place. He tells how the Torah was hidden by the mayor, the miracle of a broom in his old hand shaking. He has the face of a flower, you whisper. And that was an amazing experience to be in this place where my probably great-grandparents were married. And I've organized or created this reading based on what I call kernels or families here. And what that means is that sometimes poems speak to each other, and even through the years, and you find yourself repeating Borges or some other person's name, or even writing with another new twist on father or mother or something that still is with you and will be with you forever. So I'm going from that poem about the ancestors, really, to a poem about my father, which is very different. Some of you have heard this poem. How my 93-year-old father does it. My father, in constant rage, not gentle, wants to be alone, to spit on his floor. Two good women keep him going. When they say yes, he says no in mid-sentence. And they argue over him, the whiter one saying, that's the way it is. We have to share him, the younger one howling. I saw him first. We used to go dancing together. They are like brittle 16-year-olds scrambling to be number one. The truth is both are moving closer to his end. He breathes oxygen, which the Humana folks set down in the house. He drives his car. The one of the women took his keys away. His own young doctor is so clearly annoyed. Your father comes to my office anytime he wants. He asks about erections, and your father's 93. About the firehouse, this doctor says. No one ever went there for oxygen before. Tomorrow I fly home to teach Prometheus that business of saving the universe with fire and then enduring the eagle punishment. But my raised voice will be for my father, who, bleating and with half a lung, drove himself to the Margate firehouse and let firemen take him to the hospital. His doctor admits that was colorful. Original. But of course he is angry. No one ever did that before. Here's what you have to do. Get together, will you? He says, and one of you kids just read him the riot act, but I don't answer. It's in my eyes. It will be in tomorrow's words about Prometheus. I will speak about the fire. I will speak about the punishment. I will speak about fathers who will not just lie down, give up their secrets, and die for anyone. Okay, and then I wanted to flip to a poem that speaks to flowers, actually, and the seed is that, and I will honor a woman that some of you will recognize who sits on the corner of Craig Street right in front of the bank, or did. She knows everybody on Fifth Avenue practically, and she is the person, one of the people who sells flowers. So this is called Buy Flowers When You Can. And I fell in front of that bank. The rest you can discern from this poem. And so this poem speaks to the son, in a way, and not the father. So I'm doing a little bit of generations. Roses, chrysanthemums, daisies, carnations, and baby's breath, presided over by you, Miss So What, who sits on cans and newspapers, and whose name I finally learn when I, the nameless stranger, stand guard one day after you holler in the bitter of December, "Hey, get over here, lady, I have to pee." And you have to watch the flowers. I could pretend this corner of Fifth is a vestige of a foodless market in Amsterdam, Bruges, or Montignac when I come to Pittsburgh on weekends and watch you sell day after day irises that look like they have toes and some long-stemmed orange gladioli even on Sunday. But I think you do not care about the sadness of flowers. Your eyes instead on walkers and bikers and the resident panhandlers of Craig. Your fingerless gloves sometimes holding a wet cigarette or clanging a lot of change. I had a friend who told a story of a man who walked up to her and kissed her, then bolted down a street, and all she could do was register the surprise. I remember this when I think it must not, cannot be a mistake. My fall in front of you, damaging a bridge, the bridge of my nose, a pure raw meat display. You shooing on the onlookers, you dipping into melting ice meant to keep away wilt. You cutting an apron to make a patch for my face. I waited for the polite boys in the bank, knockoffs of my son, to find a first aid kit. They, not looking at anyone, yelling, "Ice, ice," all around us. Their buzz about risk management and options. I could have been their mother falling. We have always known they are beautiful as stallions, but that corner is yours, and you were there, and fast. So, thank you. And now, here is a poem that was written, and it's very short, just to accompany the first line of an Emily Dickinson poem. And it's not in the book, and it's very recent. And the first line was, "Perhaps you'd like to buy a flower," and you will recognize the circumstance. "Perhaps you'd like to buy a flower and see where you go with it. Who needs flowers? A single flower itself, one dandelion, one enunciated lily. Here's to the nameless person who died yesterday in a psychiatric hospital in Pittsburgh. I haven't heard if it's a man or a woman. No one knows if the flower I want to drop for him near Tennyson and DeSoto has a gender either. It's just a small blossom, but it has to be enough. The real gift has to come now from a forgiving God." Okay, this is deviating from the plan, but I will go on. The connection here will be, again, this area, and also a family member. And I remember being in a hospital in Indiana, Pennsylvania, and it was to accompany that family member, and I saw many male nurses for the first time. This was a little while ago, and someone had contributed to their going to IUP, to Indiana University of Pennsylvania, and to become LPNs. It was wonderful to see them, and there were some men who would only be treated by these men. and I watched. The professor watches the male nurse. You wear your ice mitts like a prize fighter and kneel as if in prayer, cradling those packs around his feet. You turn him over in bed, feed him his eggs with all the sureness that comes from drinking with the men in Tonoma. Before they sewed up that old mine, those buddies whose language was fouls and runs, all of them volunteers in Vietnam, all of their sons still football players, driving reluctantly now to a university some people consider the enemy. But the sureness of the IV needle, like an ancestral pickaxe in the rock, startles even you, lets your eyes meet his while you change the bag for him, give him a sip of water, and without speaking, take away his diapers. Yes, startles even you, new to holding men and rocking this one till he went under. Startles even you, who work beneath the earth like him and came up all black and proud once. Oh, I want to tell you, as I stand by this door, that every Greek hero had permission to do this, to find his sacred womanhood without making speeches. And I am on my knees to you, whose names I don't know, and to those great gods who wouldn't have any of that Shivas royal. Did you ever see a grown man cry? Nonsense. Carry your books, says Kafka, like the death of someone you love better than yourself, like an ice axe breaking the sea frozen inside you, like suicide. Yes, carry only faces and books that make you hunt relentlessly the luminous parts of your body. You, who read Balzac, recognize light, the eyes of someone's daughter at 19, somber, as a cluster of black ferns. Recognize the tilt of a disinterested young man leaning over a cradle, the truth and modesty of this Fragonard cameo, that a child must be held hundreds of times before he is toned in umber to where you swagger and swing your book bag in the world, not cold. Places. Costa Rica, two poems, one for that same son and the other coming away from that trip. Have you anything to declare? Customs declaration, it starts with this epigraph. I am bringing home no liquor, seeds, gold, pre-Columbian artifacts, just two paper figures, old women working in the fields. I have seven now, five from Mexico, now two more in my hands from Costa Rica. I can't tell you why I bought them, except that I believe they are hard workers and have endured. Have you anything to declare? Carrying two more paper ladies in my hands is not the same as carrying them in my head. I have been a guest in a country that has no army, but bands of iguanas arranging themselves in sun. I have been kept from those stories of decapitation, not being home, men masturbating at the naked feet of others. We are evidence bearers, passing through customs with baskets, wooden boxes, paintings on feathers, smaller than the other ones at home. I bring back souvenirs made from newspaper in Mexico and Costa Rica and sold in villages, in the markets, broadcasting the somewhere we have been that is elsewhere. All black bags, limited. What is it about them? The folds of their garments, the pots in their hands, the little sticks on their backs, chili peppers, a little dog at one skirt. They speak, and I think I'll unearth their stories, give them a home from Jaco or San Jose, their price so manageable, dollars into colones. 26,000 Americans have settled here. How can we not love a country with pale-faced monkeys in trees and volcanoes waiting to burst with their firebombs? We are calm in the face of it. We can take anything on a bus, especially when a pastor from Corpus Christi blesses us. I am told at home, my newspaper ladies with gasoline shellacked faces are quite flammable. But I brought them through anyway, America, maybe to help us, along with my soul, stamped Costa Rica, believing they could join us in our pain in the fields. Thank you. Costa Rica hope, talking to a fatherless son on his birthday. Of the little prince, when he didn't return, Ann Lindbergh said there's a terrible difference between lost and dead. And I stand there trying to concentrate on the extra food I arranged in the refrigerator for your monthly visit home. Shelves of bananas, cantaloupes, avocados, taking on meaning, tuning out the rest of the program, as if feeding you could tell you about colors, something about scarlet tanagers and orchids, or living loveless at the foot of a helpless volcano, bowing before getting ready to write by lava brick streams, where you were supposed to sleep. Where you are supposed to sleep, famously and well, and couldn't, facing trees with air-shaped pods, you trying to rid yourself of the former and linear, as if talking could recreate the shelf of the iguanas at your feet, in a severe canyon lathered in the sun, with red bananas punctuating the giant elephant ears, growing upside down and birds doing their popping. It's Wednesday, and the bus stops for souvenir buying, and we understand about extinct woods being replanted and walking with our guide beneath red ginger torches, as if you would ask how it was on a sophisticated bus with 24 people you didn't choose who were better than you with money and winking their way through with assorted blue miniature ox carts for grandchildren, their small bottles of water and warm imperial beer and crushable gray-bellied monkeys for colleagues, all of us eating dirty rice for breakfast at blue tables, as if you would ask about the music and silence at the Tarjos River with the egrets and anhingas content to circle the thousand mangroves. I don't know who's talking to me from this kitchen, your man back rocking to the familiar sounds of the manageable, but I am happy not to be asked about the boy in the jungle, more lovely than good air, lost in the foliage and not dead. Okay, so from that son, my son, sort of, in the poem, to Susan Sontag's poem. Susan Sontag's son, and maybe some of you know that her son, David Reif, wrote a book called Swimming in a Sea of Death, and it's a memoir of his living with his mother, whom he had to constantly say to her what she really wanted to hear, which was not that she was dying. So Susan Sontag's son finally allowed to grieve. Stories become pearls of shame, the wishes of mothers who make of sons untold dreams. Where can we go with our stories of abuse? Retell the myth of a king who cut out the tongue of the woman he raped so she wouldn't tell her sister. Do you know that story? What the victim finds is a way to talk. No tongue trying to read birds hovering, finding some way to speak what you may not want to hear. Your woman's face shines through his eyes, Susan. He is here because you are his mother and because love is daily bread and often like a God's gift, fierce. Let your son know what you know. It's not about good or bad. You will not get better. It's not a beautiful day. Illness is not a metaphor. We the people die in spite of love. And now, a contemporary poem, and it addresses my staff, so to speak, and my desire to always go out and help them, making friends with the outside men. In my yard, the pin oak with holes is abandoned by mower and lawn crew. They don't circle this tree. They stop and they come in for money and ice water. Looking around, they see the painting in pink and purple that Ben Miller left. I, knowing he wouldn't come back, he, knowing I would find it a large space. Once, in place of a lid, on his old garbage can, I watched Ben put this canvas down and leave it. Wishes and thoughts about color, our legacy now when he went to Illinois and died right away of cancer. I tell the mowers, this ragged painting was finished by a friend who didn't show his work, who didn't wait for thank you, and who never knew the names of trees. Outside, past the junipers, I hear one laugh. They never saw anything like those swirls in my house. And the man starting the motor on the mower offers to change places with the weed whacker. I'm washing glasses and can't see, but leave more water in cups on the deck. They always miss a few places, leave mower trails with tires, remind us nothing in nature needs to be cut. Remind us diseased maples make the best chairs, and not one person sitting in front of you today needs to know that. I want to share with you again how a poem sort of graduates from just something ordinary that happens, and sometimes it's an annoyance. I don't know how you feel about all the calendars that come to the house in the middle of the summer that start to give you information about, that abbreviate 4 months worth and then go on to September. Most of them get thrown away. Some of them are handsome pictures. I cannot throw them away, the calendars arriving steadily. Ocean Conservancy, National Wildlife, Sierra Club, disabled veterans arriving in September as if the world starts anew now. Baby horses, dolphins, flowers. I walk around holding this one from the Holocaust Museum. I'm on the June 2012 page. Five rings found 30 feet away from a mass grave in the Ukraine. Five rings a priest discovered in 2006 in a cluster near a site where millions were shot at the borders of the Ukraine. Eyewitnesses, many of them victims too, said the prisoners acted with the only form of resistance they had, flinging rings from fingers into the field to keep the enemy from collecting them. Father Patrick found one with a small ruby, like an eye watching, saying, "Here I am. Find me, Father. I am evidence. Help me to put all of these together." Two, someone tells a story about a man in St. Joseph's nearby hospital. He's been there for months. He is the patient who flings his eggs at the wall every morning. "No straitjacket for him," says the doctor, who knows he's a lot of trouble for the morning nurse and the breakfast crew. Now that's all he has, flinging. And you let him do it. This is someone who knows he is dying. No words. Help me to put all these together. Evidence. Thank you. Trying to find something a little bit lighter. Okay. What's in front of me here is a poem, again, that resonates with a piece of information about a survivor. It's called Hotel Montana, which is in Haiti. 10 Dead men on the top, one guest, one bellhop under, side by side beneath the rooftop, 10 dead men on the top, just to speak through the hoof of burning and sudden distance drums beating through the heart of Umoja. Two men buried through a roof where roof fell without a single corner or leaning wall or cover, only nether roads to hell from the shack and Lakay and Hotel Montana, state of Hawaii, a once and then collapse and pull out from tons of rubble by spoon. Men with big hands looking. The living talk about the cold and the string of dark souls running through, but the yay sees nothing, ears witness hope. The language they each spoke, men with big hands looking, crying. Now the two rise from splinter concrete, the one in torn red and gold pledging himself to the tourist in his Tommy Bahama shirt, dazed to see him and to be alive. The guest of the hotel waves, says to his brother on behalf of rescue and love, and not believing in the end of the world, "Nice knowing you, man. You'll have to write down your address for me." Yeah. I'm going to end. Okay. This is the last poem in the book. I want to thank my eyes. And it's called A Story of Cups with a Pended Prayer. There is one still steaming in a mountain inn close to a lake, and I have one that I glued together, that my teacher made with blue weeds inside, and one with no handle, good for pencils or sticking your toe in. Every day I lose one in a coffee room to someone who doesn't care about sludge and has the grace to return cups to shelves. An old woman brought me one with a tea kettle when I sat in a bar closed for the morning in Oahu, and a friend always brings me tea in a thin German one with a black rim. I have saved a child's broken one with a rabbit no one could throw away. Being drunk or hurt, you get a thick one in Maine. In the basement is a paper one, a soldier, never making it to the garbage. Let me come into this life a cup. Let me fit myself to fingers without being weary. Let me celebrate all these hands, these chapters moving through tight corners. Bless our many heads bending over.